I would choose beach, but not in the summer. So if I could read on a cold beach in like the fall, then maybe.
Welcome to Keep It Fictional, a weekly podcast for book lovers by book lovers. Build your to-be-read list with Sadie, Liz, Virginia, Fiona, and Corrine from the Port Moody Public Library. Warning, this podcast contains strong opinions and may cause an increase in your library holds list.
Welcome to another episode of Keep It Fictional, the book lovers podcast from the Port Moody Public Library. Today, our topic is slightly related to a topic that we discussed a couple weeks ago, all about names. Now, a few weeks ago, we discussed names of people in the title of books. Today, we're going to put a little bit of a spin on it, and we're going to talk about names of places in the title of books. And we will see if by including the name of the place in this book, if that place plays heavily in the book itself. I'm very curious. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. So I'm very curious to see what our book friends have brought for us with place names today. And we are going to get right into it. We're going to start with Corrine. Corrine, what book did you bring us and what place are you going to talk about?
So I am going to bring you to a place that I had never heard of before and got a little bit panicked as I was reading the book because it wasn't mentioned until about halfway. And I was like, oh no, have I misunderstood the brief again? My dear book friends helped me out because, as always on Thursday night, I was struggling to find a book. And it feels like every other book right now is like the Paris bookseller's wife's best friend's orphan. So I decided to go to a time-tested, true Corrine genre and go to true crime. Because if there's going to be a murder, there's going to be a murder in a place and it's going to be in the title. And so I'm going to set the scene for us. It is summer. It is horribly hot, as I'm sure we can very well imagine. And the people in the state are going a little bit crazy. They blame the heat for the strange rash of violence that is happening. And a couple of friends, outdoorsmen, decide to head to Teal's Pond in upstate New York for a bout of fishing. Now, Teal's Pond has been quiet over the last couple of years because they have made it so that you require a license to fish. And this has put a curb on the unfettered fishing that has happened in this particular place. The laws don't always stop the mountain families, the rural rustic people who live up the mountain for generations, living off of the land, who are rumored to be descendants of Hessian mercenaries. It's been a lazy afternoon for these friends. They have enjoyed their fishing and kind of getting away from the larger, we're going to go with city, of Sands Lake, New York. As they are fishing, they notice something strange in the water. At first, they think it might be a discarded bag of clothes. There are always city people coming up from New York, throwing their garbage in the ponds, and so at first they don't really think much of it. Until as they return and look again, they realize that what is a bag of clothes is a body. As they wade out into the water, they find the body of a beautiful young blonde girl floating in the water outside of a small town, and it's clear that she has been murdered. Now, if this sounds like the opening to the television show Twin Peaks, you would not be wrong. The body of a dead, beautiful blonde floating in the water, discovered by outdoorsmen, and then the ensuing mystery that follows is pretty much Twin Peaks. And that is because Mark Frost, one of the co-creators of Twin Peaks, spent his summers in and around this area, surrounded by the outlandish stories of his very eccentric grandma. And one of these stories was the story of the girl in the lake. Now, over 100 years after this murder, which occurred in 1908, two, and I'm going to gently call them Twin Peaks fanatics, David Bushman and Mark T. Givens, who have also created a podcast about Twin Peaks, decide to investigate the roots of this cult TV show. So they decide to go back to Sand Lake, not Teal's Pond because that's just the name of the pond, but that's fine. I think it still it works within the brief. And investigate this crime using modern methods. And what they find is a city full of corruption. So Sand Lake is one of the kind of small towns that outline Troy, New York, which I did not know was like the Coney Island of upper state New York. It's a place I had never heard of and kind of want to visit now. But anyways, it was kind of like the playground of the rich, moneyed classes of New York. During the summer, they'd swarm out to these areas and enjoy, you know, trees and lakes as you do. And what was even more fun were the very, very messy politics of this era and of this area. So Troy was like a hotbed of deadly politics. If you think that political systems are corrupt now, wow, you should absolutely pick up this book and take a look at how much fun you could have ballot stuffing and just like shooting people when you didn't feel like they voted for the right party. In this town of Troy, there are essentially two classes, this rich elite townies, and then South Troy, gritty, industrial, drawn along ethnic lines, rough and full of what they called back in the day, disorderly houses, which is essentially a code word for brothels, where I believe one of the madams was raking in $1 million a week in modern money. And in this kind of mixing, melting pot of different classes and people, there's also the mountain people, those who have lived in that area for generations, who have not had access to education, and who are very, very distrustful of all these outsiders coming into the area, especially because sometimes this has dire consequences for the young women who grew up in these areas, including the summer before this particular incident, where one woman was killed by her boyfriend for revealing that she was pregnant. So there's a lot of tension in this particular area, and into this steps Hazel Drew, our victim. She comes from a very impoverished family. Her parents are very cold, and they don't want her to be education, but Hazel considers herself a modern young woman. At the age of 14, she leaves home to become a domestic servant and becomes part of this class of young women who have money and are yearning for independence. And depending on who you ask, she was either a young, good woman who was trying to pull herself up from her bootstraps by working as a domestic in the house of the rich and powerful of Troy, or she was a money-grubbing, loose girl who was trying to grasp above her station. Much like in Twin Peaks, a lot of the mystery has to do with who was Hazel Drew. Was she someone that the newspapers painted her a beautiful young blonde flirt? Or, as her fiercely reclusive and deeply suspicious aunt said, a good girl who never wanted to get into trouble with anyone. The book covers both the story of Hazel as well as those who came in from the city to investigate it and their particular political strings that they needed to pull in this investigation. Is this story a story of corruption gone bad? Is it the story of a cover-up? Is it the story of people who just didn't know how to investigate crimes? We'll never know because the mystery is unsolved. That is very frustrating. So if you are a fan of true crime, going back into historical mysteries and reading a book about them and writing a book about them is a big swing because it has to be satisfying at the end that you feel like maybe you have some resolution. Otherwise, what's the point of the book? It kind of brings me back to the book We Keep the Dead Close, which was one of my most disappointing reads of 2 years ago, which was like 400-500 pages of like, well, they could have done it. Well, they could have done it. Well, they could have done it. And at the very end, it was like, oh, is it just some random guy? So what I did find satisfying about this delving into an unsolved mystery 115 years later, where everyone involved is super dead, just like really, they're gone. They're gone. There's no evidence. There's no nothing. There's nothing new to kind of uncover. Is weirdly enough, the bits about the political situation in Troy. I found it really interesting just to talk about like the corruption and the cronyism. That was really fun, so help me, as well as the fascinating look at the involvement of newspapers at that time. So this is 1908 in true crime. So these newspapers owned by William Hearst, they would send these special reporters out, including one called Samuel Clemens, who actually had no relation to Mark Twain, except that he kept saying that he was related to Mark Twain. And Mark Twain was like, "You are the worm in my shoe," who essentially self-styled himself as like a Sherlock Holmes. And this was like the case of the drowned girl. And he would go along like investigating and like accusing people of murder in these newspapers that everyone was reading. And he was like investigating clues, and he found a bunch of her letters that the police apparently couldn't find because they were in the basement. It's wild. It's absolutely wild what you were able to get away with back then. Absolutely fantastic. So the book that this is, and I think if you're interested in Twin Peaks, this might be like doubly interesting to you. I've never seen Twin Peaks. I'm never going to see Twin Peaks. I'm sorry, Virginia. Maybe I'll watch the first season, but the only thing that I know from it is that video of like the person doing like a little dance and then everything being like in rewind. And I was like, this makes me feel bad inside. So yeah, if you're a Twin Peaks fan, the foreword is by Mark Frost. Is The Murder at Teal's Pond, Hazel Drew and the Mystery That Inspired Twin Peaks by David Bushman and Mark T. Givens. Yeah, it's a very interesting read. As I said, like, it's really tough to write a satisfying true crime where the ending you don't know. And I'm going to agree to disagree with their findings. At the end, they're like, well, it's probably these guys. And I'm like, but was it? What proof do you have? And you have none. But if you're kind of interested in these like very historical true crime stories that really investigate, like take a good look at like the actual context of the situation that they were happening in, I would actually recommend the podcast Buried Bones by Kate Winkler Dawson, who is a journalist and a writer who has written some very, very good true crime books with Paul Holes, who is one of the investigators on the Golden State Killer case. And they actually are bringing in modern forensics or modern investigation techniques into these old crimes so that you feel a little bit satisfied that, you know, they might not be able to solve it, but they have a pretty good idea and could build a case as to why, as opposed to like, well, they rented a carriage, so it was probably them. Yep. So that was our trip to Upper State New York. It seems hot and murdery.
The first thing I would like to say is that I can definitely understand how heat would cause people to start killing. I get it. 100%. I get it. Heat is horrible. And also, I need a resolution. I think that's why I can read mystery novels, but not true crime, because I need to be able to close it and say, it's done. They know who it is. There's no chance that this person is going to come and sneak in my house at night. They're going to come. They're going to kill me. Yeah. Well, thank you, Corinne, for bringing us to upstate New York in a hot and humid and murdery time. All right. Next, we're going to go to Fiona. Fiona, what place and what book are you going to tell us about today?
So my book takes place in Berlin, and it is creatively called Berlin by V. Sutton. I love place-based literature. And I also love the audacity of naming your book just like a city, because it's like, no, forget all those other times, all those other people. This is Berlin. This is what you need to know about Berlin. So I have also gone a bit dark in my choice. This is a psychological thriller, and I'm going to call it a literary psychological thriller. And when I put literary in the front of a genre, what I mean is that it's not fast-paced. There's lots of reflection and fancy words, and that is what I like. But other people might be like, oh my gosh, please just get to the point. Stop like describing people that you see reflecting on your childhood, which is what really got me about this book and what made me enjoy it, as opposed to like, I'm not usually really a thriller type person. So this book is set in 2017 and it follows Daphne, whose life has recently blown up in London. She slept with one of her customers at the cafe that she works at. And instead of like kind of dealing with the repercussions, she just quits her job, leaves her flatmate, and just takes off to Berlin. And that is kind of her way. Daphne tends to deal with things in that way, just cut them loose and start anew. She loves the feeling of starting new. And it just makes her feel clean and like, this is, you know, this is the life. This is going to be the time. And she finds a lot of people are kind of starting their new life in Berlin. And she gets into the social circle with the other people she's taking German classes with. and just gets very involved in the culture there of the kind of expat gap year culture. And for her, it also involves living off her parents' money. So she doesn't take a job. She just kind of does her thing and convinces her parents that she's there to learn German. However, she has some not great feelings about herself not working, and just in general has some not great feelings about herself. And so, as is her way, she tells a lot of lies around why she is there. She tells people she has an au pair gig. She tells other people she is doing her master's in philosophy, when in truth, she's actually applied and been rejected from many colleges. And those aren't really the end of the lies that she tells. She tells lies about everything. Especially to men. She finds that everything from the mundane and unimportant to the things that will please her. Oh, they like cycling. She loves cycling. Why don't they go cycling together? Just anything she could kind of do to please those men, sort of regardless of whether she likes them or not. She just wants to be adored. So Daphne finds herself in sort of a not great living situation. She decides to look for a flat for herself, and she finds one that she can take over. Well, the renter is going to be in New York. And of course, she makes a couple lies to get that flat secured. Yes, she's a good student. She's studying philosophy. She makes up some references because this is the perfect place. This is the very best place to start anew. It is the moment. This is where everything, her new life, is going to start. And she does secure the flat. She builds a great relationship with the renter, and things seem like they're really looking up for her. She's very happy to be there, but in her first night, a rock gets thrown through her window. This sort of triggers a series of events and some paranoia in Daphne that really just spirals into more accidents and more incidents. And Daphne doesn't really have the resources to handle them. Definitely lots of trigger warnings for this book. Daphne has an kind of severe unrecognized eating disorder that plays into it quite a lot. There is stalking and kind of like some borderline, like non-consensual relationships. So there were parts of it that were difficult. And I found that Daphne is almost presented in this way of sort of just, I'm not sure what you call it, but like a typical character who events are happening to her that happen to many young women in this age bracket. And instead of finding that alienating, I actually found that I sympathized with her quite a lot. And that was a very interesting experience because she's so awful. She's just always lying and making bad decisions. But for me, it reminded me like very tangentially of Kim Ji-young, born 1982. Just this sort of, I didn't find that other reviewers were saying this, but sort of this parable of, and look at what patriarchy does to some young women, like psychologically, and the spiraling difficulties that can create, and then the lack of ability to recognize those in oneself because you're so entrenched in this patriarchal culture. And yeah, and she does reference like a lot of like Wolf and Sylvia Plath. It kind of gave me like a little bit of like the yellow wallpaper feeling where you are like, you're having this existential dread, but you also really kind of like connect with and feel for that character. So in that way, I feel like it hit the psychological thriller beats well. I also just found it entertaining. There's a lot of, you know, you learn a lot about Berlin in the prospect. This very kind of like negative side of expats, particularly young, educated, wealthy expats who do a lot of drugs. That's another warning. There's a lot of drugs in this, and drug-related violence. So I was struggling to decide whether this would be satisfying to thriller readers. I do think that like if you're just looking for something punchy that like resolves in a satisfying way, this is a little more cerebral than that. But I found that the writing itself carried me through, and the observations about Berlin, about Daphne as a character, and the very like psychological nature of the story made it quite entertaining. I wouldn't necessarily recommend it if you're like, hey, I want to go to Berlin. Maybe I'll read this book about it. But perhaps if you are someone who has been to Berlin, or has been to Europe in that sort of capacity as a foreign resident, just sort of, you know, there to learn German or get to know the culture, I think it could be quite interesting. So that is Berlin by B. Setin. I think it came out this year. So yeah, I recommend it with some caveats.
Berlin, thank you so much, Fiona. I think I will not be picking that one up. But it is. What I love about this podcast is that we always have such a wide range of books and that there are books for everyone on it. And that one, I don't think is for me. I don't think that one's for me. Thank you so much for bringing it to the podcast and bringing it to our listeners today. All right. I am going to talk about my book next. And the book that I'm going to be talking about is called The London Seance Society. And this is by Sarah Penner. And this is Penner's second novel. The first one, which is The Lost Apothecary, I think that Liz actually talked about, maybe just in the most anticipated episode a couple of years ago. And ever since then, it has been on my TBR, but I have not been able to find a time to read it. The London Seance Society came out earlier this year, and I initially read it because I was looking for an audiobook, and it was available immediately as an audiobook. And so I took it out and listened to it driving to and from work. And I'm really glad I did because I really ended up liking it. One thing I will mention, which for me was very, very strange, just kind of goes back to our book about names, is that one of the characters has my daughter's name, which is just a little bit odd. She is a character who is not alive throughout the entire book. And so it was a little bit strange to read my daughter's name, but I was able to kind of separate my daughter from that experience. Now, unlike our title suggests, our story actually begins in France, and it begins at an abandoned chateau just outside of Paris in the year 1873, and it starts during a séance. Now, this séance is not your usual kind of smoke and mirrors, hidden compartments, illusions type of séance that you might see in kind of the more polite parlors of grieving elderly widows. This séance is only attended by four people, two of which are the mediums themselves. It is being held at midnight and has the potential to be extremely dangerous. And that's because this particular seance is being held to find a murderer. Lena Wicks is there as understudy to the renowned spiritualist and medium Vaudeline Delaire, who is running the seance. Vaudeline specializes in this particular type of seance, and she charges quite a big fee to the families of murder victims to summon their loved ones' ghosts and find out directly from them who killed them. Now, Lena is still not entirely sure that she believes in spirits. She's always preferred facts and science, rock samples, things like that, over something that she can't see and has absolutely no evidence of. Before this, her only experience in seances was when her best friend and lover, Eloise, and her father died a handful of years ago. There was no foul play suspected, and so the seance was more just a chance for their loved ones to say goodbye. The seance was performed by members of the London Seance Society, which is a gentleman's club that specializes in seances, ghost hunts, other kind of similar endeavors. And honestly, nothing really happened during the seance, and the whole thing left Lena doubting spiritualism even more. However, everything changed for Lena 3 months ago. On All Hallows Eve, she found her younger sister, Evie, stabbed to death in the garden of her parents' hotel in London. Evie herself had been a student of Vaudeline's, and in the months leading up to her death, she had taken an almost obsessive interest in spiritualism and mediumship. And she had distanced herself quite a bit from Lena, who had always been very close with her. And Lena honestly had no idea what she was up to in the weeks before her death. The police, as usual, gave very, very little attention to Evie's murder. And so Lena decided that it was up to her to find out what happened to her sister. So 2 weeks earlier, she crossed the English Channel in search of Vaudeline Delaire, the one medium who could help her. But Vaudeline had left England very suddenly and without explanation months earlier and refused to return. Now, this kind of seance can only be performed in the place of death. And so Lena decided that she had to learn how to be a medium herself so that she can return to England, summon her sister's ghost, and find out who murdered her. Now we go back to London. And we follow the story of Mr. Morley, Mr. Morley is the vice president of the Department of Spiritualism at the London Seance Society. And Mr. Morley is also trying to solve a murder. A few months earlier, the president of the society, Mr. Volkman, was murdered at Mr. Morley's own evening soiree. Well, the police did take more interest in Mr. Volkman's death than they did to Evie's, but they still had no leads on who the killer was. Over the last year or so, the society had been losing prestige, losing a lot of money due to some problems within Mr. Morley's department that had led to some of their seances being seen as fraudulent, rumors being spread that they were just trying to get money out of people, and quickly they started losing customers and they started losing money. Now with Mr. Volkman's death, Mr. Morley is worried that they may not be able to build their reputation back up. So with some prompting from a fellow society member, a Metropolitan Police Constable Beck, Morley reaches out to the one person he can think of who can figure out who killed Mr. Volkman, Vaudeline Delaire. Vaudeline is shocked to hear of Mr. Volkman's death, as they were quite close before she left London. And she's even more shocked of Mr. Morley's request that she return to London to perform his seance, since it was Mr. Volkman himself who, in an act to save Vaudeline's life, encouraged her to leave London in the first place. But Mr. Morley assures her safety, and so out of a care and concern for her old friend's memory, Vaudeline decides that she will go to London and perform the seance. Now, Lena sees this as her opportunity. Lena does not have to learn how to be a medium if they go back to London and Vaudeline also performs Evie's seance during that time. So she decides to accompany Vaudeline back to London, agreeing that they will go their separate ways when they get there. They'll meet back up after Vaudeline has performed Mr. Volkman's seance and they will perform Evie's. This all changes when they get to London. When they arrive in London and Lena first sets eyes on Mr. Morley, she is shocked. She is shocked because Mr. Morley is wearing a hat. Seems pretty normal, but he's wearing a hat that Evie would wear all the time, a hat that Lena did not see on her body when she was discovered, and that Lena has not seen since Evie's death. Quickly sharing her observation with Vaudeline, they decide that instead of separating, they will team up, stay together, and both go into the society to try to figure out what exactly is going on, what Morley's connection is to Evie, and why he has this hat. So from there, we have a very tense couple of days for Lena, sneaking around the society buildings at night, disguised as a man so as not to attract attention within this male-only society, secretly searching through logbooks and sign-in books to find any evidence of a connection between Evie and Mr. Morley, and desperately trying to figure out what exactly is going on within this corrupt society and if it could have led to the murder of her sister. But what Lena doesn't realize is, obviously, there is way more going on than just a connection to her sister. And she starts to realize that maybe her sister is not the person that she thought she was. Lena and Vaudeline quickly become trapped in this society and trapped in a very dangerous situation. And neither of them fully recognizes the danger they're in or has any idea how to escape from it. Our book is told in alternating perspectives. We have Lena and we have Mr. Morley. And so we see Lena figuring out her sister's final footsteps, following the path that she discovers when she's at the society of where Evie went and how she's connected to it. And then we hear firsthand from Mr. Morley as he remembers his encounters with Evie and how she came into his life and what her connection to him and to the society is. There are many, many twists in this, some that I was able to guess, some not quite as obvious. Definitely did not end the way I thought it was going to end, which is always a good thing, I think, sometimes a good thing. In this case, I think it was. So it was a bit of a shock at the end, but in a good way. Yeah, and it was kind of fast-paced. And if you're looking for a Victorian sort of mystery with a bit of a supernatural element to it, I think this would be a really good fit. Kind of seeing the two perspectives was really interesting. The Mr. Morley's perspective is in the first person and Lena's is in the third person. So it kind of gave kind of those very different perspectives. Yeah, so it was interesting. And listening to the audiobook was also interesting because it was two different readers for those two characters. I would definitely recommend, if you're looking for, as I said, a Victorian mystery with some supernatural elements, The London Seance Society by Sarah Penner. All right, we are going to go on to our existential question next. And this is going to be a would you rather question. And our would you rather is about reading location. So I'm wondering from my book friends, would you rather read on a beach somewhere, sunshine, beautiful sand, or would you rather read inside, cozied up with a cup of tea or a cup of coffee and a blanket? I know I'm setting the scene. Am I prompting maybe just a little bit? I'm pushing people towards one or the other. So yes, I'm just curious, where is your ideal reading location? Which of those two would you rather read in?
So I'll be totally honest. I hate the beach. I love summer. Don't get me wrong. I love the summer. The heat is a lot right now, but I don't actually mind it as much as I mind being cold. But my sticking point with your would you rather situation is the beach, which I hate because it's boring and I don't understand why you would go there. Genuinely, just sitting on the ground, but like intrusive ground that gets everywhere. So I'm going to have to go with cabin, even though I truly hate winter and don't like being cold. But I'd rather take that over getting sand everywhere.
I'm going to agree with Corinne, and my beef with beach reading is actually the sun. I don't understand how people do it because the page is so white and the sun goes on the page and then you blind yourself. And I already find like reading visually difficult, and I just don't understand, and I want to, but I don't. But on the flip side, I also think that cozying up with a beverage in a cabin is like best place in the entire world to read. So yeah, easy peasy.
I was telling Virginia before we started that I would choose beach, but not in the summer. So if I could read on a cold beach in like the fall, then maybe. But yes, I think it's quite obvious that I would pick the cozy up inside one that I would not have to kill the mosquitoes, which I've killed two of in this room this morning. I just want to point that out. Two inside this room. And you wouldn't have that in the cabin.
Yeah, but that's just Port Moody. That's just Port Moody. Vancouver has no mosquitoes right now. I've been bitten like 18 times here. None at home. Also, the beach during the fall is the most disgusting combination of words I think I've heard. That and winter camping.
Yeah, I can get behind you on the winter camping. That doesn't sound fun, but it's like find a nice like fallen log with some like beautiful fall leaves above you. Yeah. I'm also a big fan of like bench reading in the fall. So just finding like a bench somewhere under a tree and reading under it. I know. All right, Al, what about you?
Oh man, I definitely have to go with the cabin. My family in Manitoba has a cabin, and it is legitimately one of my favorite things to just curl up and read on the big comfy plush couch there. Ideally with the rest of my family also there reading. That is one of my favorite places in the world to read. So I'm a little bit biased, but yes, cabin 100% all the way.
All right, Virginia.
It's such a hard question, Sadie. cabin.
Yeah, that one I suspected. My wild cards were Fiona and Corinne. I wasn't sure what way you guys would go. Fiona, I know you like the outdoors. You like being out in nature, but
yeah, and I would like to say that I do like winter camping. I think it's great. But I also want to pose the flip side is, would you rather read in a snowbank or read in a hot room with no air conditioning in summer?
That's literally what I did last
snowbank.
Night. That's my life right now. That's what's happening every night in my house. Would still take it over the snowbank.
I don't know. If you have like a huge, big, like waterproof snowsuit on, you can just like lean back and
Enjoy the hypothermia. Yeah.
See, I think with cold and with wetness, as long as you have the right outdoor equipment, you're okay. Got a good pair of waterproof boots, got a good pair, like good jacket. Fine.
It gets in your bones. In your bones. Doesn't matter how many jackets or like Bessies you wear, it's in your bones. Whereas like if it's hot, just put like a cold cloth all over your entire body.
If it's cold, you can put on more layers. If it's hot, you cannot peel off your skin. I will take the cold.
Yes. Yes. All right. Well, before we devolve into complete chaos, let's move on to our next book recommendations. Al, we're going to go to you. And what book and what place are you bringing us today?
So I am bringing us Nevada by Imogen Binney. And this book starts off not in Nevada, but in New York. So Maria is a 29-year-old trans woman living in New York. She works for a bougie bookstore that she's worked at for years, since before she even transitioned. She lives with her girlfriend, Steph, and things seem to be going, in some ways, well. But Steph and Maria's relationship is rocky, what with Maria's dissociation from her own emotions and Steph's frustration with her distance. Maria is considering breaking up with Steph, too, though it's hard for her to feel strongly about it. Maria is consistently late for her job and finds it hard to care about that, too. Eventually, everything comes to a head. Steph breaks up with Maria. Maria gets fired from her job. And the house of cards that is her life comes tumbling down. With nothing better to do, or at least so she thinks, Maria borrows, or really steals, Steph's car, buys a bunch of heroin, and sets off on a road trip to try and figure herself out. On the other side of the country, in Star City, Nevada, is James. James is a 20-year-old stoner, heavily dissociated from his own life. His girlfriend, Nicole, is frustrated with him, though he can't find it in himself to care much about that, or at least not enough to do anything about it. He secretly fetishizes the idea of himself turning into a woman, but represses that pretty hard. He works at the Walmart, the main employer in the small town. When Maria walks into that Walmart, she immediately decides that James is a trans woman and just doesn't realize it yet, and decides that this is what her road trip was all about. Maybe by helping James figure himself out, she'll figure herself out along the way. This is a book that is low on plot and heavy on character work. And while I normally can enjoy that, I did find this book a little hard to get into. I think this is in part because the book is about the trans feminine experience, or should I say a trans feminine experience, because Maria's voice is really singular. I'm a trans masculine person, so while there's elements of the experience in here that I can relate to, in other ways, the experience is completely different from what I know, because I'm approaching transness from a different direction. But Maria's voice is incredibly strong, and it carried me through this book. Though I think my favorite chapter is one near the middle, which we get from Steph's perspective, which crashes right through Maria's internal monologue to remind us that she is a heavily unreliable narrator who is not as good at hiding things as she thinks she is. Nevada is a powerful little book, and what it does best is deconstruct the idea of transness as a monolith. It takes the simple idea of transness, the idea that someone knows they're trans since they were young, start on puberty blockers and hormones as soon as they can, maybe get a few surgeries, and then live happily ever after as their true gender, and complicates it fiercely. This is a book about the real messy trans experience, and in that regard is deeply relatable. If you're trans, or if you want to understand trans people a little bit better, then I'd recommend picking up Nevada by Imogen Binney. It won't hold your hand, but it will maybe punch a bit more understanding of the complexities of this particular human experience into you.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Al, for sharing the book and also for sharing a little bit of your experience as well. And I think that's a great, great recommendation for anyone who's wanting to learn a little bit more about that experience. All right. Our last book is going to be from Virginia. Virginia, what place are you bringing us to today?
A garbage truck careened around the corner, heading straight towards the Oruba Hotel. It didn't stop. When it got to the hotel, it crashed right through it. And then an explosion. A bomb was detonated. Amidst the rubble afterwards, Hadi, the junk dealer, spotted something on the ground. He rushed over, picked it up, shoved it in his pocket, and he hurried home. He went straight to his shed when he got home, and inside was a table, and on top of that table was a body. But not a body of one person, but a composite, a body made of parts from many different people. Hadi took out what he picked up from the street earlier, a nose, and it fits perfectly on the face as he had suspected. With the nose sewn on, the body is complete. Hadi calls it What's His Name, and tomorrow he's going to drop What's His Name off at the police station, and the police will have no choice but to deal with it. Because it is a complete body, the police will have to give it a proper burial. And that's all Hadi wants, the recognition, the respect that all the people that made up this body deserve. But the next day when Hadi woke up, What's His Name was gone. It has disappeared. This is the beginning of Frankenstein in Baghdad by Ahmad Sadawi. And with this book, he was the first Iraqi author to win the International Prize for Arabic Fiction in 2014. And when the book was translated by Jonathan Wright into English, it was shortlisted for the International Booker Prize. Frankenstein in Baghdad is set after the U.S. invasion and during the occupation of Iraq. And we experience this surreal life in Baghdad through the different people that we meet in the book. People who live alongside day after day with explosions and car bombings, coming back to your home, finding it miss a window or the wall has fallen off. Living in a world where the American helicopters flying overhead is so loud that you have to stop your conversation because you can't hear each other anymore. In a world where people being dragged off the street, dragged into questioning for no reason. We meet all kinds of people living in Baghdad. We have Elishva, who's waiting for her son Daniel to come home. It's been years since Daniel was forced to go join the war, and her daughters has even erected a grave for Daniel because they know that Daniel is dead. But Elisha believes that he is still alive. And every week she goes to church to talk to her daughters on the phone because the church is the only place that still has a working phone line. And her daughters will beg her to come join them in Australia and leave the country. But Elisha won't do it. She continues to live in Baghdad with her cats, so that she can be there when her son Daniel comes home. We meet Mahmoud, a journalist working for a local magazine whose boss has started taking him on car rides and these meetings with these like government officials or these like people that seems to have a lot of power or wealth. And Mahmoud is trying to figure out like, what is the angle here? What is his boss trying to do? And why is he taking him along? And it becomes increasingly concerning for Mahmoud when his boss starts not showing up at work or showing up less and less frequently and leaving Mahmoud in charge. And his boss doesn't even take his cell phone with him. He just leaves it in the office and he keeps ringing. And whenever Mahmoud looks at it, has on the call display, it will have no name, but it will show the number 666. We meet a brigadier named Mahid, who works for the Track and Pursuit Department, a secret government agency. And this department employs astrologers to predict and to figure out when and where the next attack is going to be, where a disaster is going to happen. And Mahid is supposed to pass this information to his higher ups, and they will be able to prevent the attacks or sometimes not. And since this is a secret department, no one knows any of the work that Mahid has done. But he wants people to know his name. He wants people to know all the good that he has done for the country. So he's looking for that one big case, one thing to get him out of the track and pursuit department and put him in the spotlight. We meet Faraj, the real estate agent who's taking advantage of the war to make some money. We meet Abu, the hotel owner who can't afford to own the hotel anymore. We meet Aziz, the coffee shop proprietor who provides a place for the locals to share stories, like Hadi, the junk dealer, and his outrageous tale about what's his name, a body that he supposedly created that has allegedly walked away. And of course, the central metaphor of the book, what's his name? A composite body that begins with a mission that seems to be pretty clear what he's supposed to do. But as time goes on, he's not quite sure what he's supposed to do anymore. In the beginning, what's his name believes that all his body parts come from innocent people, come from victims. But as his body falls off and needs to be replaced, he starts to wonder about victims who become criminals and criminals who become victims. And are there still people who are innocent in this city? And is there a winning? Is there end to this cycle of violence? What does all of that mean? What does it mean to all the people who have lost their lives? And like what's his name, we're trying to piece together from the lives of all these people in Baghdad, what it's like, just get a glimpse of this really strange reality of the world that they live in. And it's a shared experience, but you know, the author reminds us it's not a singular experience. We can't forget that each person, each of these dead bodies is more than a number. And it's weird because the book is very heavy, but the subject is heavy, but yet it's a very surprisingly quick read. And I think it's really got credit to the author and to the translator, because it's such a good translated work that doesn't feel bogged down. It's like the words are really natural. The writing is so good. I think it just, you know, when it's good writing, you don't notice it. You know, it gets out of your way so that you can focus on that story. And I think that's what this book does. And it's a book that really defies definition. Some people call it a dystopian novel. Some people call it science fiction. In France, it won a fantasy award. It's definitely horror. You got supernatural. You got a dark, dark satire. And the author plays with all these elements to create this really surreal story about how pointless war is. But because it centers so much on people, it makes it a really, really compelling read. I would highly encourage everybody to check this book out and just to get a glimpse of that reality, because as outsiders, we'll never understand what it's like. But the author provides us with that glimpse of what it's to be like to live there. So this is Frankenstein in Baghdad, and it is by Ahmad Sadawi, translated into English by Jonathan Wright.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Virginia. And thank you to all of my book friends for taking us to Nevada, to Berlin, to upstate New York, to Baghdad, and to London on our journey of place names in book titles today. That is all that we have for you for this episode, but tune in next time for another episode and some more book recommendations. This is Keep It Fictional from the Port Moody Public Library. Have a great day, everyone. Bye.
Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please tell a fellow book lover about it. You can find a list of all the books we discussed in our show notes. Join us next week for another fun book chat. Until then, keep it fictional.